The following podcast is brought to you by Newfie EVP, Talking with the Dead in Newfoundland. Jump on Amazon.ca today and get your free sample of the best-selling ebook in Unexplained Mysteries.
It's the odd to Newfoundland. Ghostly greetings from your host, Jonathan. Mysteries, ghosts, monsters, and lore. East Coast Esoterica and so much more. If it's up to you, friend, it's on the up to Newfoundland.
Ghostly greetings from the oldest city in North America. I'm your host, John Mallard, bringing you the best in East Coast esoterica. You, my friends, have stumbled upon the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast for the month of March 2016. It's the Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10 special. Yeah, you got it, man. Every year I do this. Every year I'm loving it even more. For the third year running, I'm proud to say that this is the Sci-Fi on the Rock special for the year. Sci-Fi on the Rock, of course, number 10 will be April 1st, continue on through April 3rd, 2016, at the beautiful Sheraton Hotel right here in wonderful Newfoundland. You got it. And of course, it can't be Newfoundland without the Odd to Newfoundland. I myself will be making an appearance, of course, but my appearance pales in comparison to all the wonderful other guests who are going to be there. I'm so excited, especially for, oh man, Robert Picardo from Star Trek. You might remember him as the Doctor. Yeah, he is definitely my favorite hologram next to that one of Michael Jackson that was around a few years ago. You know, what can I say? I'm a bit of a sucker. Billie Jean is not my lover. Eugene Simon from Game of Thrones. Oh my God. I hate to ask him, like, what was it like knowing you were going to die the whole time you were on, you were reading, doing your read-throughs and stuff like that? But it's going to be fun to meet Eugene. He, of course, will also be appearing at Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10. J.M. Frey, who is a voice actor, she's going to be joining us. She's also an author, sci-fi and fantasy. And, oh, man, definitely the guest I'm the most excited about because I get to relive my childhood. Oh, yeah, Goku, you got it. He's coming, guys. He's coming. Yes, Goku is coming, man. Kirby Morrow, the voice of Goku, and a cast of other characters. Well, that's just the one I'm a total mark for. What can I say? Kirby Morrow. Yeah, I'm excited to meet that guy. I think it's great, and I'm a huge Dragon Ball Z fan. I know you guys don't know that, but you know, you got to learn a little something about me all the time too, doing these podcasts. I love Dragon Ball Z. I watched it since I was a kid and continue to watch it in theater when the new movies come out, by the way. Love Goku. And I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful addition this year. This year, of course, we'll be hosted by none other than Fat Apollo. And Fat Apollo is no stranger to our podcast, of course. He graced it there a few months ago promoting Atlanticon. But he will be the host once again this year, which is very exciting. Michael Mikulski, Fat Apollo, is such a nice dude. And just to give you an example of what kind of a man this guy is, I, of course, am going to be participating in Sci-Fi on the Rock. You know, and I promote it with the Life After Death Society. I always try to put a video out every year and promote my table and promote my panel I'm going to be hosting and stuff like that. So I put together this little promo video, which was really cool and highlighted. But I just knew something was missing. I needed something fun that people would really gravitate towards. So I messaged Michael and was like, Mike or Fat Apollo, I got to know, is there any way I can turn you into a jump scare? So Fat Apollo's like, absolutely, and sends me five of the most ridiculous pictures of him. Like, and I mean ridiculous. Like, one of the pictures, he's dressed as King Hippo, or should it say undressed, because all he's wearing is boxers and the crown, and it was just hilarious, so I had to put it in there. Guys, jump on the Life After Death Society Facebook page if you want to check out that promo video. It's worth the cash, man. It really is. It's hilarious. And I'm so looking forward to Sci-Fi and Rock number 10. Speaking of which, I do have two guests who will be participating at the con. From MUFON, Laura Gilbert, who will be hosting a panel about ufology, as well as Chris Walsh, who is, how should I put this, a new author on the block. And, of course, Chris Walsh, he wrote the Sword and Steel saga. And let me tell you, just two really wonderful people I've had on my podcast. They're both going to be part of this. Sci-Fi on the Rock is huge, and let me tell you, every year it gets bigger and better. The Sheraton is definitely the biggest it's ever been. So here's to a great con, and I'm so excited. But there are things in my life that are even more exciting, and I'm very proud to say, finally, after many, many, many months, it seemed like too many, my little son was born, Sam Joseph Roy Mallard. 9 pounds, 9 ounces, came on the 24th of February, and I'm so proud to be a daddy once more. I now have a gentleman's family, my precious darling little girl, Faith, and my happy little boy, Sam. I'm so happy to say that he is healthy, 10 fingers, 10 toes, and his mom is doing wonderful as well. We were watching wrestling together the other night, and it was just so cool to actually have another guy in the house to kind of even the odds. So there you have it. Congratulations to me. And I kind of feel like I should share that with you guys because, let's be honest, the people who listen to this podcast, you guys are my friend, right? You should know about that kind of stuff. Speaking of wrestling, I do have to go off topic. I'm not talking about the paranormal guys, I know. But I do have to mention something because the news of this actually came out earlier in the month. Now, I am a huge wrestling fan. I have been for years. And let me tell you, my heart broke when I heard some sad news this year. Like I said, I am a huge wrestling fan, and on occasion I do listen to wrestling podcasts. I am a huge fan of one in particular, though, and that's Solid Monster Sounds Off. My heart is just full of hope for you, Mr. Solomon. I'm letting you know right now, buddy, we're pulling for you over here on the Other Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. We heard, of course, earlier in the month, on the I believe it was the February 7th, he told the world, of course, that he does indeed have blood cancer. So our love is going out to Mr. Solomonster himself. Okay, guys, listen to his podcast. It's friggin' awesome anyway. If you like wrestling and you like someone who's going to dish the real dirt on wrestling and tell it like it is, because wrestling right now is just, I didn't want to go there. But I'll tell you, this guy just, he really rings true to the common man who loves wrestling. And there's nothing wrong, there's nothing to be ashamed of with being a wrestling fan. And let me tell you, I just hope for a speedy recovery for Mr. Solomonster over there, okay? So Jason, get well soon. So there you have it, guys. I got my shout-outs out of the way. I promoted my guests. I've done it all. And it's time now to bring you guys the paranormal news for the month of March. So, since we're all talking about babies... Since we're kind of excited about the birth of my son, let's just say that some ghosts aren't exactly at legal age. Because there's been a mother who's filmed a ghost in her baby's cot. Jade Yates got the shock of her life when she saw something unusual sharing her daughter's ruby cot. The footage, which was later uploaded online, shows what appears to be a human-like shape next to the sleeping child, which dissipates and reforms several times throughout the video. According to Yates, the door to the room had been closed and nobody else had been there at the time. She also believes that the footage shows two spirits, one a small child and the other an adult. Ruby was not settled at all, she said, but she does wake every hour or so at night. Maybe this is why, someone wanting to play. I don't think they are nasty as the adult looks to be so attentive. Now, you can see this footage, of course, it's online, footage which can be viewed below. I mean, you can get that footage pretty much anywhere. Just look up Mum Films Ghost Baby in Cot next to her sleeping daughter. Guys, it's worth the look. It's pretty creepy and pretty compelling. I love those kind of stories because you never know. Maybe right now there's a little ghosty upstairs with my Sam. I have a feeling he's about to be rudely awakened, that ghost, because let me tell you, that kid does not want to sleep at night. He will not be resting in peace. taxi, taxi. Oh, Taxi drivers pick up phantom fares in Japan. All right. Several cab drivers have reported having strange experiences in the area hit by the 2011 tsunami. It might sound like something out of a book or classic ghost stories, but according to at least seven cab drivers from the city of Ishinomaki, a region that was devastated by the tsunami 5 years ago, some taxi passengers have been mysteriously vanishing from their cars without explanation. In one incident, the driver had picked up a female passenger near Ishinomaki Station who had asked him to take her to the Miyamina District, an area that was badly damaged during the disaster. The driver asked her if she was sure she wanted to go there as the area was almost empty, to which she chillingly replied, "Have I died?" When he returned and turned around, the woman had completely vanished. In another case, a taxi driver in his 40s recalled picking up a male passenger who asked to be taken to Hirayama, a word that translates to mountain, and pointed in the direction he wished to go. The driver set off, but a short time later he realized that the man was gone and his cab was empty. These stories, along with several others, are collected by Yuka Kudo, a sociology student at a course at a local university that I cannot pronounce, as part of her graduation thesis. In each of these cases, the drivers had genuinely believed that someone had got in their vehicle and could offer no explanation for now or how they had managed to get out while the car was in motion. Many of them also reported that the fact that the passengers had all been quite young. "Young people feel strong chagrin when they cannot meet the people they love," said Kudo. "As they want to convey their bitterness, they may have chosen taxis as a medium to do so." Very strange. You know, the first thing that pops in my mind, of course, is if these really are ghost people getting picked up for a fare, what would they pay you with? What do you think that would be? What do you think they'd pay you with? I don't know. I have a feeling it'd probably be light change. Did you know that there's so many ways to pay up? And sometimes the best way to pay up is with the truth. And when it comes to disclosure, there's been a lot of that going on with the government lately, especially when it comes to ufology. Navy whistleblower has claims, and he also claims knowledge of UFOs. An unidentified U.S. Navy officer claims that he saw evidence of UFOs at the Moffett Field Naval Base. The 49-year-old, who has so far refused to reveal his name, maintains that he saw and handled hundreds of top-secret photographs and documents pertaining to the UFO phenomenon. A third-class petty officer in the U.S. Navy during the 80s, the source claims that he examined the classified files during his stint at the Moffett Field Navy Base in California between 1986 and 1989. "I have never seen a UFO or ET or alien. However, I have seen literally tens of thousands of documents confirming they are real and have visited Earth," he said. "I would like to share my knowledge in hopes that someone will be able to use it effectively towards disclosure." The whistleblower, who has filed a report with UFO investigation network MUFON, is also believed to have been working with former UK Ministry of Defense and UFO investigator Nick Pope. "I've actually had some personal communication with this individual and have no doubts about his background," said Pope. "It's clear from the language he uses that the information he has that he's a genuine insider." According to the whistleblower, the reason it had taken so long for him to come forward with his story was that he had signed a non-disclosure agreement that had only expired 2 years ago. "I do not possess anything other than my testimony and documents that authorize that I legitimately had the individual top secret security clearances," he said. But this is a rabbit hole that goes ever, ever deeper. It makes you wonder, you know. If there's nothing to hide, why? Just why is it? Why do you think that these people will sign these papers saying they're not allowed to disclose the information? Think about that for a second. Like, okay, perfect example. Let's use the world of sports and baseball. Like, eventually things come out. Things that are documented by sports and training staff and stuff like that. Like, how many times have we heard somebody who, I don't know, maybe won a World Series eventually is a part of a steroid scandal, but it doesn't really matter because it was like 10 years ago, because there's disclosure. It makes you wonder just what the heck is going on? I mean, in my mind, I really do believe there's something to this UFO agenda, which is why it's so cool to have a member of MUFON on a little later in the show, I might add. I tell you what else would be pretty cool. Oh, man. Imagine if drivers find your road blocked. Now, I know traffic is very common, but just imagine if the roadblock was something a little different. Yeah. Maybe it's not a traffic jam or maybe even an accident. Maybe it's something prehistoric. Drivers find road blocked by a triceratops. Isle of Wight residents were left perplexed earlier this month by a dinosaur in the middle of the road. The huge prehistoric reptile, which authorities in Godshill believed had been moved to the road by pranksters who had stolen it from a nearby garden, ended up completely blocking off the high street. The model's owner, Martin Simpson, runs a local shop selling prehistoric gems and fossils. It takes about five blokes to move the dinosaur a couple of inches, so it was definitely a concerted effort and drink was probably involved, he said of the incident. Thankfully, local authorities were eventually able to move the dinosaur back to where it belonged. Like, I'm sorry for laughing at that. I might sound like a total just jerk for really seeing the humor in this prank, but oh my god, they put a triceratops in the middle of a double lane and blocked it completely. Like, oh man. Yabba dabba doo, guys. Yabba dabba doo. Remember, guys, check your cribs at night and your cots, because you never know if there's a ghost in there with your baby. Hey, taxi to the afterlife. Yeah, be careful, because after that tsunami hit, you might be looking for a fare from the other side. There's a Navy whistleblower who says he's got more information, and he's even in contact with the wonderful Nick Pope. Drivers find a dinosaur in the middle of the road. It's blocked off. Man, all these stories have been odd to Newfoundland.
The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal podcast does not accept donations. In lieu of this, the Stella Burry Foundation is a registered charity established in 2005 to secure financial support for the work of Stella's Circle. Learn more and please give generously at stellaburry.ca. And now, back to the show.
Thank God. It's time for oddities.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Boy, that escalated quickly.
I want to believe.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
Oddities.
All right, guys, welcome back. Of course, it's now time for everyone's favorite part of the show. I love it too. My brand new segment called Oddities. You got it. 10 unreal facts that are actually facts and very real about our natural world all around us. They're just all odd if you ask me. Let's dig in with number one. Did you know most household dust isn't made of actual dirt? It's actually made of dead skin cells. Oh, yeah, that is the grossest thing I have ever heard. Think of all the people who scratch their butts and their hair and all the... Oh, God. Do you know you're breathing that in constantly? Think about that. You're breathing in other humans right now. Little strange? Little sickening? Let me just say there's other weird things out there. 1 in 8 million people has progeria, a disease that causes people to grow faster than they age. Think about that. They grow faster than they age. I think about my little Mansky upstairs and how fast he's going to grow up. Let's hope he's not a sufferer of that. Did you know that the male seahorse carries the eggs until they hatch it instead of the female? You know what? I kind of feel like a male seahorse this week. It was definitely a release for me to see that child come out. Oh, God. Everything's baby related for no reason at all. Did you know that negative emotions such as anxiety and depression can weaken your immune system? You know, that's interesting. It's kind of paranormal when you think about it. Why is it that stress actually weakens our immune system? Why is that? Is it because of different chemical reactions? Or is it because we're designed to be happy, happy people? Well, let me tell you, in this day and age, we all could use a good laugh. And I really hope this podcast does it for somebody out there tonight. Did you know Stephen Hawking was born exactly 300 years after Galileo died? It's pretty uncanny. Pretty uncanny. That's some good math there. Apparently, they're both really good at math. Did you know Mercury is the only planet whose orbit is coplanar with its equator? You know what? I actually had to look that up, coplanar. And basically, what it means is that as it rotates, it doesn't move a whole lot. So its actual axis is kind of there, and it kind of rotates. The center of the planet doesn't move. It actually stays in center with the rotation. That's pretty cool. It might be clear as mud to you guys, but go figure. It's definitely a weird fact. The Morgan Sphinx moth from Madagascar has the proboscis, or tube mouth. You might see those on flies as well. That is 12 to 14 inches long to get the nectar from the bottom of a 12-inch deep orchid discovered by Mr. Charles Darwin himself. So think about that. He sticks this gigantic mouth tube. It evolved to have a 12-inch to 14-inch mouth tube just so he can drink from these flowers. Like, that to me is just insane. Just insane. Think about the amount of evolution that had to go into that for that to even be possible. Man, so cool. So different. Did you know some moths never eat anything as adults because they don't have mouths? They must live on the energy they stored as caterpillars. Make no wonder they eat so much. In 1958, entomologist W.G. Bruce published a list of arthropod references in the Bible. The most frequently named bugs from the Bible are, and I quote, locust, which is 24, the moth, 11 times, a grasshopper, 10 times, scorpion, 10 times, caterpillar, 9 times, and bee, 4 times. Interesting. Also, another cool, interesting fact about insects, people eat them. Yeah, it's called entomophagy, people eating bugs. It has been practiced for centuries throughout Africa, Australia, Asia, the Middle East, and North, Central, and South America. Why? Because many bugs are both protein-rich and good sources of vitamins, minerals, and fats. So, there you have it, guys. Why don't you save a few bucks on the groceries? Yeah, you know where I'm going with this. Go grab a shovel. Go look underneath your mats. A crunchy, delicious dessert is just waiting for you around the corner. I hear a Disney song kind of in my head popping up here. I think it might have something to do with Hakuna Matata. Did you know grapes explode when you put them in the microwave? Go on, try it. Okay, are you done yet? Are you dead yet? Okay, don't be dead yet. And of course, guys, I'm going to leave it with these. I got to have a little something. Since I just had a child, I got to have a contraceptive, you know, themed last little oddity for you guys. Did you know Ramsay's brand condom is named after the great pharaoh Ramses II, who fathered over 160 children? Holy Vera, Pharaoh Batman. Holy crap, guys. I hope you enjoyed oddities. I'll be right back with tonight's special guests.
The following podcast is brought to you by Newfie EVP, Talking with the Dead in Newfoundland. Jump on Amazon.ca today and get your free sample of the best-selling ebook in Unexplained Mysteries.
And welcome back to the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Our first guest tonight is a member of the Mutual Unidentified Flying Object Network, also known worldwide as MUFON. The main objective of this group is to answer the question, are we alone in the universe? The longest-running UFO research group in history has recently taken on Wonderful Soul, who I met during a charity event, Ghost Hunt, at Admiralty House this past October. She's admittedly new to the ufology field, but that's okay because she's a Newfoundlander born and bred, and she'll be one until she's abducted herself. Here to speak on a plethora of topics and about her upcoming appearance at Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10, Laura Gilbert joins me tonight on the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. How are you tonight, Laura?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
I'm so excited, and it's great to have a fellow Newfoundlander on the podcast. That doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't.
You know what's funny? I actually struggle to have Newfoundland guests on my podcast. Isn't that weird?
That is very weird. Newfoundlanders are typically very big on the stories and the ghosties and the goblins, so it is a little unusual that you don't have more Newfoundlanders.
But you know what? It all comes down to the topics and stuff like that, and some people want to speak and some people don't. So I'm really glad you're here tonight to speak with us, because let me tell you, I've never had anybody from MUFON on, and I'm so glad you're a Newfoundlander. It just fits perfectly. You know, I got to ask you, Laura, when did this love for, shall we say, ufology actually start? When did this love actually become a part of your life?
I have to say, from a very young age, my parents always encouraged me to be in the sciences and technology, and being in those type of realms, you definitely become exposed to sci-fi and fantasy and all those types of genres that go along with it. So I've always been a big fan of sci-fi movies. But then I started thinking, what else is there? And one of my favorite movies growing up, and still is Independence Day. So I started learning about Area 51 and looking up books and just learning as much as I possibly could. In grade 6, the first real big UFO book that I read was The Day After Roswell by Philip J. Corso. So that kind of highlighted the conspiracies and the mysteries surrounding the Roswell crash. So really that kind of started my passion. And ever since then, anything mysterious or UFO or alien related, I've been fascinated by.
That's so great. And it's good to hear that you've been kind of interested since you were a kid. You know, myself, I can remember as a kid being just obsessed with the weird stuff. And it's kind of funny thinking back on it now because I never ever thought I'd get into the paranormal like I'm into it now. I can remember as a small child going to my cabin up in Holyrood, and my mother would pick me up a copy of the Weekly World News, which was this old newspaper. It was about 20 pages long, and it was just full of the most ridiculous stories. Most notably the Bat Boy stories, you know, Bat Boy found in cave and all that stuff. So when I think of my childhood, I think I had a pretty weird upbringing as well. You know, it all has come to a head really and led you to here. Why did you choose and why did you decide to join MUFON?
Well, I think as I've grown older, I've been really actively listening and following the field. And something that I've really noticed over the past while is that a lot of the researchers and the people that are following this field are aging, and a lot of them are male. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's always great to incorporate women in science and technology, and even in this type of, you know, parascience field. So I think that was really important to get more women involved in the field. As well, I think making sure that the stories and the research techniques and skills are carried on to the next generation are really helpful, especially as some of these people that have been involved for many, many years do age.
Gotcha. And you know, it's funny you should say that. You're not. You're absolutely right. Pretty much everyone who's on podcasts and shows and TV and stuff like that right now, who are names in the ufology field, are actually ancient. And there's no doubt about that. I guess, Laura, what you're trying to say is that you're going to be the new blood, and I'm glad to be a part of that. By the way,
I'm looking forward to it. I'm really excited.
Here's a loaded question for you. I got to ask it. And right away, when you said MUFON, I actually read that you're going to be a part of Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10. Of course, we'll be talking about that a little bit more in the podcast. But you know, right away, I got to ask you the loaded questions that everyone's going to ask you. Do you actually believe that there are aliens among us?
That is a great question. So I think there's two different realms to the whole concept of UFOs and aliens. So UFOs in one aspect is just unidentified flying objects. So that could be a whole realm of things, ranging from extraterrestrial to top secret military exercises, that kind of thing. So then when we get into the alien realm, that's a whole other kettle of fish. So when you start talking about it, there's things like the Tall Whites, which is Charles Hall's story, where he was working at a base, and the Americans basically had this whole race and community of aliens living on the base. So some of it is pretty far extreme. However, I do believe on some level that there are aliens here among us, whether they are microbes, or, you know, sentient beings or people that live amongst us, I really don't think I've made up my mind on it. I know that's kind of a cop-out answer. However, I've seen evidence for various realms. However, as a scientific mind, as someone who tries to follow analytical processes and reasoning, I really can't narrow that part down.
I'll tell you one thing that really got me excited the last couple of weeks. You know, I'm a huge physics nerd. I'm going to admit it. My opening argument to anybody who does not believe in the paranormal, in particular EVP research, my opening argument is that, you know, this in physics is unexplained. And we actually finally proved the existence of gravitational waves.
I know, amazing. This
is immense. Huge news for ufology. This is probably one of the biggest discoveries that would lend to the idea that space travel over long periods and distances, if you had the right technology, it would be possible to travel faster, aka time travel.
Absolutely. Very interesting anecdotes and rationale to kind of look at it from an interdimensional point of view. So if you kind of saw Interstellar, the movie that was released last year, that had to do with more dimensional time travel and rather than world-to-world travel. So there's lots of different theories and ideas that kind of provides some context for what these things could possibly be.
You know, I just know I'm very excited to finally see another one of Einstein's theories proven correct. The guy is awesome. 100 years. It only took us 100 years to prove something we already knew pretty well for sure.
It is amazing.
And, you know, I got to say, I'm either going to be in two camps when it comes to UFOs and aliens. I'm either going to believe that UFOs are real and not piloted by extraterrestrials, or I'm going to believe they're both somehow connected. Do you think that maybe alien abductions and flying saucers are two different phenomena?
I think they can be two different phenomena, absolutely. But I think a lot of them go hand in hand. There has been some examples where one happens without the other. There is an interesting story, and you might have seen the videos online. I think his name is Stan Romanek. So he has lots of videos and anecdotes and people around him, you know, that quite clearly say, and there's videos that he has experiences with entities, not necessarily in UFOs. However, some of it is quite compelling. However, he's had a lot of legal issues lately with, unfortunately, very terrible child pornography charges and all sorts of stuff like that. So his credibility is pretty shaky at this time. So there's lots of, unfortunately, as most debunkers and skeptics would say, a lot of this is anecdotal information and qualitative data. But anyone that's in the science realm would also say that there is a valid place for qualitative data. Not everything can be quantified. So it is really interesting to see the paradigm of evidence.
Interesting. You know, no matter where we go to in this planet, okay, there's going to be different cultures. And it seems like every single culture, every single religion, it seems like they all have one thing in common. We always look to the sky for answers, whether it be a god or maybe even an extraterrestrial being. How do you feel about the idea that maybe aliens are just, you know, being mistaken as angels? The idea that these entities, these beings from another planet could actually be something we mistaken thousands of years ago and wrote into the Bible. Perhaps even Jesus himself was an ancient astronaut. What are your theories about all that? How does religion fit into this for you?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I think that, yes, if our knowledge and the unknown is there, I think a lot of things can be misconstrued and misunderstood as things that are easier to understand. So in times, aliens could have easily been mistaken for angels because that was the most logical conclusion at the time. The mind goes for the most logical, easiest thing to comprehend. Quite often we don't try to jump to those crazy conclusions or something that's really out there. So I think it's totally possible. I know that there's been a lot of emphasis now on ancient aliens and there's all these programs about it. So a lot of the artwork and you know, historical documents does make reference to these type of otherworldly figures, you know, gods from above, that kind of concept, which there's a lot of parallels between abductions, experiences, all the different types of close encounters in these religious texts. So it is very interesting to see the similarities.
And I'm glad there's somebody out there who actually knows that. You know, the more I delve into the paranormal, as you know, I'm all about, you know, the spirit communication. That's my thing. That's what I do. But I love to branch out and learn more about the paranormal. And it seems to me like the more you research, the more you learn from different aspects of the paranormal, whether it be a good old-fashioned conspiracy theory to magic to anything like that, it all comes back to really the same idea that all this stuff might actually be connected. You know, there's a great chance, and I've heard a lot of people talk about UFOs and Sasquatch being connected. I've heard.
Absolutely, yes. I've heard a lot of that too, yeah.
Is there anything in your mind that actually sticks out in your own research that you think might be kind of like, shall we say, the sore thumb when it comes to ufology? Is there one thing you really notice repeated over and over and over again that just keeps you coming back for more?
I think the most compelling thing for me is a lot of the disclosure agreements. a lot of the interviews with former military personnel and RCMP officers, that type of thing. So people that are in positions of high trust, high responsibility, that report these type of things. People that you would give a lot of credibility to and have no real reason to lie or make things up. I mean, it would basically damage their career. So if someone's willing to go on the line to say, no, I really saw this, that's so compelling. The Rendlesham Forest incident in the UK, there's been some big ones in Canada, like the Shag Harbour one in Nova Scotia. There's been RCMP officers in Clarenville and Grand Falls, Windsor, and Bishop Falls. These people all go on the line. And, I mean, the chance that this could possibly ruin their career because of the stigma and the jokingness and the lack of seriousness that ufology actually gets is truly compelling. Why would these people basically threaten their livelihood to say, nope, this happened to me? That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I get the same thing a lot with the paranormal investigating stuff. I always get the, oh my God, you don't actually believe there's actually ghosts, do you? And I'm like, oh, well, you know, I have some data here that might change your mind. He's like, well, I'm not really a believer in the spiritual realm or like that, but when I was a kid, I'm pretty sure I saw a shadow person.
Yeah,
it happens
exactly.
All the time.
Paul Hillier was the former defense minister for Canada, so he has some really interesting interviews and presentations that he's done, and he is a complete and utter believer in UFOs and aliens. And, I mean, a high-profile guy. I believe he was even the deputy prime minister for a while. And he says, it is all a cover-up. There are aliens among us. There are several species among us. We're working with them. Things like microchips have all come from them. So a lot of his presentations are on exopolitics. So what that is, it's a field of research that combines science, education, public policy, and how that's all associated with extraterrestrial life. So that's a really interesting person that's been really high up in Canadian politics that is a total complete believer.
You know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that there's a cover-up of anything that could be detrimental to our society and the things that really the pillars that hold our society together, i.e. our currency, our religious beliefs, and really our borders. Those are the three things that keep us all going, believe it or not. And, you know, the more I see a cover-up, the more I believe. And I see it in media all the time because, you know what? As technology advances, you must notice that media is putting out more stuff to kind of muddy the waters as about what's actually going on. I use the Men in Black movie as a great example of how to muddy the waters of what's really going on. If you like Men in Black, those three movies, okay? Great movies, by the way. I love them. I love Will Smith in general. But these movies, they have taken the idea that aliens are among us and turned it basically into a joke.
Absolutely.
So do you feel like, was there kind of like one case that you've researched, you know, whether it is one that you're involved in or not, do you feel is the most relevant to ufology? Like, I think Roswell incident or the Phoenix Lights, those are the two things that pop in my head when I think of ufology because, my God, they've just been covered. That the horse has been beaten well past its death. But is there like kind of like one story or one, shall we say, incident that really just boggles your mind?
Those are two really good ones. I have been really into the Rendlesham Forest one lately. I think that was in 1981. So that was a combined U.S. Base with the British Air Force. So that one, a craft actually landed. These people actually went out. And if you Google, just do any sort of search, the men and the soldiers that were actually involved in that one, there's actually a voice recording as they were going towards the craft. And, I mean, if you hear the people's voices during as they're approaching this thing, that they have no idea what it is. I mean, it just sends chills up through your spine. And they've come forward since, and they've actually talked about touching the craft and how they've had messages full of ones and zeros, so all these binary messages transmitted to them from these strange hieroglyphs. And, I mean, these are military personnel. And, I mean, not grunts, not, you know, just inductees. These are, like, serious men who were in the military for all their careers. So it's a very interesting case. Nick Pope talks about it quite a bit. He was a he was in the Ministry of Defense in the UK, and basically his job was to dispel all these UFO claims and stories. So it's interesting to hear his perspective on stories like this. So I think Rendlesham is a really, really great example of high-caliber witnesses, very compelling evidence, audio-visual evidence, and former defense ministry personnel that have come forward. So it's just a really compelling one.
That's so cool. I love how much just knowledge I can just take from you right now. It's wonderful. I feel like some kind of strange demon just sucking the UFO brains right out of you. I'm loving it.
Anytime.
Can you give us a real-life Newfoundland UFO sighting? You know, I, for one, have never actually heard... I've heard two from friends of mine, but I've never actually heard of a UFO or anything going on like in Newfoundland or even Labrador. Can you give us an example of something that might be actually have happened here?
Well, there's one that when I was growing up, I lived in Grand Falls, Windsor. I'm a townie now, unfortunately.
hey, watch out. This podcast is from the oldest city in North America.
When I was growing up, my father used to always tell a story about a UFO that was seen over the mill, the pulp and paper mill in Grand Falls, Windsor. And when I have searched it recently, it was actually reported as a multicolored jagged edge UFO. And so that was really interesting. And it was actually seen over Bishop Falls as well. So that was in July of 1969. So it was quite a long while ago. My dad would have been a boy, so I'm sure he would have heard about it because it would have been the talk of the town. But what's really interesting about that one is that there were RCMP reports about that one. And then another one that was just recently in the news was another RCMP officer from Clarenville who was stationed there at the time. In 1978, he saw these blue lights, and it was about 2,000 to 3,000 feet up in the air over a little island out by Clarenville. And he said it was 5 times faster than a plane, and it was at 2 a.m. in the morning. So his account recently made the news again because he finally felt comfortable enough to actually speak out about it. So this was kind of, hush-hush for many, many years. That's a really new, exciting one. But what's really interesting is that the National Research Council used to actually collect UFO data. But in 1995, due to budget cuts, they actually stopped. So at this time, it's kind of a piecemeal, collage of UFO reports from various sources. So it makes it really difficult to collect that data now.
Yeah, I would say. And, as technology has gotten better, it's something that is that just boggles my mind. If there are so many UFOs out there and so many abductions, stuff like that going on, and this can pertain to anything in the paranormal, everybody has a camera with them now. Everybody has a video camera, high-definition video cameras and cameras. How come there isn't more evidence being, shall we say, observed or captured?
A lot of stuff, but I think we're so quick to dispel it. For example, in the last 25 years in Canada, and this is from a 2014 report, there have been 14,541 cases reported in Canada.
Oh my God. Sounds like you got your work cut out for you, Laura.
Yeah, it'll be busy.
We are getting close to the end of our session together. What I will say, though, is I have to know, Sci-Fi and the Rock's coming up. I'm super excited. I know you're super excited. Can you tell us about your involvement with this year's anniversary? Sci-Fi and the Rock is celebrating its 10th time. Oh, man, it's just going to be great. What can people expect from you? What exactly are you bringing to the table to Sci-Fi and the Rock?
So I will be talking about the major topics, the major events that have been located worldwide, as well as really local ones. I'll also be talking about the major players in the field of ufology. And I'll definitely do this all from a local perspective, from a true Newfoundlander. And also there will be an opportunity to share a story. So if you do have an experience, I'd love to hear, and I'm sure the people in the audience would love to hear too, as long as you're comfortable, of course. So yeah, we're really going to delve into the topic. And it'd be really great if we can meet like-minded individuals, and who knows, maybe we can come up with a group and have regular meetings to share these types of stories.
Well, let me tell you, I would love to sit at the table with you guys. It'd be an honor. And one thing I love, too, about sci-fi is that we get to meet people who are just like us. We're paranormal nuts. We are just, I know you're into UFOs and I'm into ghosts. That's okay. But we both love something that's very strange. And that's okay. It's a whole new way of being geeky. And every year, what I'm noticing is that the paranormal is getting bigger and bigger at Sci-Fi and the Rock. And I'm so excited for that. It seemed like it was only me doing it for a while, but now you're there. I'm so glad to have you there, man. I really am. I'm not part of the committee, but like I'm like the unofficial paranormal guy now. I name myself.
That's great. I'm so excited to be part of it, and I'm so honored that you had me on the show. I really appreciate it.
And, of course, I will be recording a live podcast at the show. That's going to be April 2nd, 9 o'clock. I know you're on at 6, I believe.
5 to 6 in the Nimoy room.
Yes, and I'm going to be in the Roddenberry room at 9. I'm going to be going on the same time as the dance. Reason being, of course, some people aren't that, you know, into the dance. But I'm going to be doing open mic ghost stories, so don't be afraid to drop by, Laura.
I'll be there with bells on.
So there you have it, guys. Sci-Fi and Rock number 10. Go see Laura's Newfoundland's only member of MUFON. She's going to be there between 5 and 6, of course, talking all about ufology. Laura, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast tonight. You take care of yourself, okay?
Okay, thanks.
The following podcast is brought to you by Newfie EVP, Talking with the Dead in Newfoundland. Jump on Amazon.ca today and get your free sample of the best-selling ebook in Unexplained Mysteries.
Okay, welcome back to the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. My next guest will be helping us escape from the mundane world we live in into the world of gold and steel, baby. Ladies and gentlemen, Newfoundland fantasy writer and a personal friend of mine, Mr. Chris Walsh. Chris, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, boy. Things have certainly changed for Mr. Walsh, haven't they?
Yeah, you could say that for sure.
You know, I think back to 3 years ago at my first Sci-Fi in the Rock, and I see Chris walk up to the aisle, and he says, "Oh my God, Johnny, how are you?" Yeah, we haven't seen each other in years, and we strike up a conversation, and the first thing out of his mouth is, "I'm writing a book."
Yep, those were the first words, yep.
I'm writing a book, and I said, "Me too."
That's right, yes, you were still writing yours then.
The Gold and Steel Saga. What inspired you to write this series of books, Chris?
I mean, going back as far as I can remember, I've always been a fan of fantasy in general. Like a lot of my favorite childhood movies were movies like The Last Unicorn and that sort of thing. And then as I grew up, I got into Lord of the Rings. And as I grew older again, and got into Game of Thrones. And, you know, it's always just continued from there. I mean, it's just always been a huge part of my life. So when I decided that I wanted to write something in long form, the immediate choice for me was to write what I had already loved, which was fantasy.
Makes great sense, Chris. You know, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, you got to write about what you love, right? And
exactly.
You want to know, I'm going to let everyone out there listening to my podcast know right now that he loves this a lot because he's not just writing a book. It's a series.
Oh, it's a huge series.
Yeah,
it's
how many books are in this series or do you have planned?
Well, that's the interesting thing because right now, counting to a book that's going to be coming out April 1st, there's going to be 7 in the whole series. And that's just the main series. Like, this is just the first story that's emerging from this whole world that I've created. There's already, you know, a whole history in the world when we get into the first book, and that can all be turned into books later on down the road. There's talk about books coming out that are taking place well after the main series. So, I mean, this could, you know, if I can get these books out there, and after Spirits of Steel comes out April 1st, if this can start turning into a profitable venture, well then, hey, you know what? There could be a lot more than 7 books.
Well, there you go. I hope I get to have you on my podcast at least 7 times promoting each one of those books, by the way.
Hey, you can have me on here 14. 16 times ago.
Well, we'd have to find a lot more to talk about. Now I'm scrambling.
I don't think that'd be hard for me and you.
Probably not. We do go way back to the good old wrestling days. How long do you think it'll take before the saga finally ends, Chris?
I don't want to get into the trap of giving a set date, because that's what George R. R. Martin did, and we're still waiting for book six from him. So I don't want to turn into another George R. R. Martin where people will say, hey, where's the next book? And I'm like, ah, I'm still writing this, but today they're saying, well, it was supposed to be out by now. And I'm just standing there shrugging. So I'm just going to say that my aim will be to try to have a book out every 2 to 3 years. But I'm not going to put any kind of pressure on myself to try to hold that. Or if one gets released earlier than that, that's great too. But, I mean, 2 to 3 years is usually reasonable expectation for books of these length. Because my first book is coming out, and it's going to be 696 pages. So these are big books. They take a lot of time to write. The first one took about 4 years to write, but the main reasoning for that was because I had a whole world to build. And I had never written a book before. I had written short stories, written a bit of poetry over the years, but I had never written anything quite this big. So to take on a task of this size and to create a whole world behind it and history and geography and all that, it took about 4 years of putting it all together. But now that everything is in place and the main story is pretty much more or less plotted out, I have an idea where I want it to end up. So it's just a matter of writing it from here. So yeah, maybe 2 or 3 years' time, we'd be talking about the next book.
That's great. And let me tell you, Chris, I'm hoping to have like millions of listeners by then, and we'll hopefully get you a chance to sell even more copies of your first book.
Oh, hey, let's hope.
You know, Chris, many people write themselves as a character in their own books. Is there any one character or multiple characters in your series that borrow from you as a person, or even your own characters in your own personal life that are in there? I know that if I wrote a book, I'd have to stick my best friend in there and just make him a total goofball. Tell me, is there any character in your book set to say that actually borrows from the Newfoundland version of Golden Steel Saga, which is the saga of Chris Walsh?
That is actually a really good question. I mean, every single character in this book, in some way, was influenced by, you know, people in my own life. That's where the best writers get their characters from, is, you know, they draw from experiences they have themselves, either, you know, through first-hand experience or from, like, watching the news and that sort of thing. So, I mean, for me, if there's any one character that really reminds me of myself, I wouldn't say there's any one. There's little bits of me in most of the characters. Like, there's little bits of my own personality in there. And there's little bits of my friends and my family that might shine through in some other characters. People might say, hey, that kind of reminds me of someone I know. There's probably, I would say, even some of the protagonist characters that would be more so based on some of, like, in some little details, some little qualities might be based on, you know, some of my friends and associates, whereas some of the antagonist characters would be more maybe based on, say, maybe people I've seen on the news that might not be in such a good light in people's eyes and that kind of thing. So it's, I would say there's just a broad cast of characters that are influenced by a broad cast of characters I've come across.
Oh my God, does that mean there's like a Donald Trump code?
I will not comment on Donald Trump.
I can see that now. Blatant racist hides among his riches, waiting for the perfect time.
Done by the time Donald Trump really showed us that he had truly lost his marbles, so yeah. He might not be in this one.
I just hope he loses his marbles altogether and starts throwing money around. Maybe then we can get these books published, you know, by big companies.
Hey, that'd be great. If you don't throw $1 million my way, I won't argue with him.
Let's do it. Let's turn this into a movie. Who are your favorite writers, Chris? I know I got a few. Oh my God. How can I not mention my favorite writer of all time, because I'm such a paranormal nutcase, Brad Steiger. Is there anybody out there who are, how shall we say, the cream of the crop for Chris Walsh when it comes to actually writing fantasy, which is what you're writing about?
Well, obviously, I would have to say Tolkien, number one. Simply because, you know, he was the one that really kick-started my love of fantasy. Yes, I mean, I mentioned before that, you know, growing up I had other fantasy sources that I really liked, but one that really drew me in and made me a lifelong fantasy fan was Tolkien. And my favorite book to this day is The Hobbit. I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy too. But The Hobbit was first and foremost for me. After Tolkien, I would have to say, of course, well, George R. R. Martin. I know it sounds really cliche picking Tolkien and Martin because they're like they're the two biggest ones right now, the two biggest, most recognizable names in fantasy. But I mean, they're the most recognizable names for a reason because they're both amazing writers. You know, I've also been reading, you know, the books of Robert Jordan. Right now I'm reading Patrick Rothfuss's Name of the Wind, and that's also a very, very good book. And outside of fantasy authors, I would say if I had to pick another one, it would be Michael Connelly, the mystery writer.
There you go. Me, I always had a soft spot for Brian Jacques and the Redwall series. Those were my absolute favorite books of all time, mainly because I like to think of animals killing themselves and screaming at each other and using weapons. I always thought that was cool. But that's neither here nor there. Chris, what's your dream?
That's very interesting, yeah.
Chris, what does your dream come true when it comes to being an author? You know, I'm an author as well. My dream come true is when people are touched by what I write. I think that's why I do what I do. And it's like anything I touch in my life. If it inspires people to do something, to be more than just, you know, typewriter monkeys out there, that's my dream come true. But what's Chris Walsh's dream come true as an author?
You know, I would have to pretty well agree with you there. My dream as an author, you know, I mean, a lot of people might say, you know, the answer of, you know, I want to sell X amount of books or I want to be on the New York Times bestseller list. But for me, that would just be gravy. For me, what I would really have to say would be my dream is if people come up to me with my book and say, your book has touched me in some way. You know, your characters speak to me. Your characters have inspired me. Your characters, your story have uplifted me. They've helped me through hard times. That is what I aspire for. I don't really, you know, I mean, you know, selling books is great because that means I can keep doing what I love. But for me, it's really been able to connect with the readers.
Do you find it's a way to, how shall we say, give back to the fans when you do these conventions? Now, how do you plan on giving back to the fans and the people who've supported you at Sci-Fi and the Rock 10?
Well, as you mentioned before, you and I have a history going back in the wrestling days.
Yeah.
And that is an industry that not only thrives on, but survives on the ability to give back to the fans all the time. So for me, going to this convention now, I've been to four conventions before. Three conventions before. This will be the fourth one that I'll be attending, and the first one where I have my own booth. So for me, as a fantasy writer, I mean, I've had instances where as a wrestling manager back in the day or a wrestling referee more recently, where I can give back to the fans in that setting. But for me now, going to the convention, it's going to be a whole different setting where I can give back to the fans again.
Awesome.
So you know, I plan on drawing from the wrestling experience that I've gained over the last decade or so and using that as a, a backstop, a backrest for Sci-Fi and the Rock Convention, something to draw from, inspiration and experience to draw from when going into the next convention, and, you know, really using that to help me get back to the fans.
And I think it's really, really great when an author can actually reach out and just touch the people who've read his book or who are interested in what they do, and I think that's really what a sci-fi convention is all about. It's not about showcasing. You know, I'll be honest with you. One thing I cannot stand about conventions is having people talk about how much money they made at the convention. I'm so happy about it. It's like, I sold X amount of, you know, friggin' flying Nimbus brooms and I made this much money. And then you have the other people who are like, oh my God, I got to talk to people about what I love to do, and it was so uplifting. Like, to me, like, that's what a con is all about. If they took all the vendors out, I would be hurt because I love buying trinkets and stuff, but at the end of the day, I don't think really that's why people go there. I think people go there to connect. And do you feel that the convention itself, how should we say, is suited for your type of book?
Oh, I mean, it's 100% suited to this type of book. Well, it's a sci-fi convention. I'm a fantasy writer. You know, but to touch back on what you were saying, I absolutely agree that, you know, the sci-fi convention is all about connecting. It's not about merchandise. I mean, you know, you have storefronts where the same merchandise is on sale. You can go there and buy that without having to pay for a $30 you know, need a tag to get in. So, I mean, at the sci-fi convention, that is a chance there for people like you, people like me, who are writing and trying to get back to the fans, to connect with fan bases, to connect with new fans, to hopefully inspire people to maybe, if they've always wanted to do this yourself, to go out and give it a try.
You know, one thing, I'll definitely say this. I'll never forget last year when you handed me that sample. I'll never forget that. And I was like, what the heck is this? And you were like, this is the book. It's almost ready to go. And here's a sample. I want you to read it. I was like, what? It was like, how many of these did you print off? And you were like, six or something. I was like,
three. Just three.
You printed off three. And it to be honest with you, I actually read it three times. Because I read as an editor as well. What I mean by that is that I'll read it over once and just read for continuity. Then I'll read it over again to actually listen to what I'm reading. And then the third time, I actually read it in reverse.
Oh.
Yeah. I try to read it in reverse to see if everything connects the dots, so we say, to the last paragraph. And after doing that, I mean, I had to read your book three times, or three chapters, whatever it was. I can't remember now.
Three chapters, yeah.
It took me literally 2 months to get back to you about that book.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did, I wrote the review, and I was like, genuinely, I don't like fantasy, but this is actually fun to read because of the characters. Who's your favorite character in your book, Chris?
Favorite one in the book? Oh, God. Well, she's going to be the face of on the cover, Lady Orange Club. She would have to be my favorite by far.
Can you give us any kind of inkling at all? I don't want to ruin your book or anything like that, but can you give us any kind of inkling about her character, about what she would say in a situation or anything like that?
Give me an example of the situation.
Okay. Let's say she's got a knife through her throat. What would she do?
Well, Lady Orange Claw, she wouldn't flinch, for one. She's practically fearless. She got a very strict moral guidelines, and she will not flinch against that. She will not bend against that. She's very proud of her beliefs and proud of her values, and she's not one to shy away from being the first to say that. So if someone had a knife to her throat, first thing she would ask is, are you going to kill me, or are we just going to stand here? Second thing she would do, as soon as she saw an opening, she would try to disarm her attacker. And third thing she would do is most of us say, okay, now she's going to go back on the offensive herself, and she's going to try to go after her attacker. But no, that's not her style at all. What she would do is she would make sure that attacker can't get at the knife, and that they have a chance to talk and figure out why that person is trying to put a knife to her throat in the first place.
Wow. See? And this is the synopsis for the next two books. We already have a murder scene. Awesome. Just call it a brainstorming session.
There you go. I love it.
You know, Chris, I know you're from a very special part of Newfoundland, the Southern Shore.
You got it.
Represent, baby. Represent.
Oh, I know it.
I'm a big fan of the shore. Up the shore, we like to call it, of course. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't think it'd be fair to anybody up the shore without talking a little tiny bit about the folklore from up around your way. You know, this is a paranormal podcast, Chris, so go ahead and dish it on us. Talk to us a little tiny bit about some of the weird things that might be going on the Southern Shore.
Well, the Southern Shore, as far as, you know, paranormal happening, folklore, that kind of thing, has very, very rich history. Well, in firm number one, the Southern Shore is one of the oldest inhabited places in North America. It was one of the first to be colonized. It's right here. And most of the settlers were Irish. I mean, all my ancestors are Irish. And as you know, the Irish are people themselves who have a very rich paranormal history, you know. And, back when the area was first settled, there was a story going around, and it's, you know, it's still in print today. Jack Fitzgerald has even wrote about it. And basically what that story says is that one of the first settlers, who was Irish, came over here, and they accused him of bringing the fairies with him. Now, that settler, he ended up landing in Calvert here on the Southern Shore, which is named after, of course, Lord Calvert, who was also Lord Baltimore, who later went on to settle Baltimore, Maryland. But this settler, when he came, apparently he went up into this meadow just outside Calvert. And when he got up there, they claimed he had the fairies. And that whole meadow was supposed to be enchanted by him and little fairies that he had crossed the sea with. And to this day, people still say in that particular meadow that things can get a little weird up there. You know, you get these strange sensations like you're not alone, like the strange sensations that someone is following you, and you turn and there's no one there. So that, to me, that little meadow up there, that's probably one of the more, I guess, paranormal hotspots. Another one would be back in 1966, the town of La Manche was washed out. But before that, it was a thriving little fishing community. You know, it had a great little bus population comparable to any other little town here on the southern shore. But what happened was the tidal wave came in and washed it out. It wasn't any kind of real strife or major disaster in that regard. There was no loss of life. But the town was situated on the rocks, so it ended up getting washed out, whereas other towns on the shore lost their wharves, they lost breakwaters, they lost fishing stages. But La Manche was the only one that more or less was a total write-off. So the people ended up leaving. The town itself, where the town was, in my childhood, there was a bridge that had fallen apart. It was gone, but there was still a couple of cables there. And over on the other side, you can see this house that was still there, still standing. It's gone now, of course, because they got a new bridge there, and it's part of the East Coast Trail. People go through there all the time. But there was one house still there. There's still a few foundations to be found down there. And I've heard from different people who've gone through there and spent the night camping in the old town itself that the town is haunted. That's the word. Now, maybe it's just people's imaginations running wild because, you know, hey, it's an abandoned community. And it's one of the more accessible abandoned communities in Newfoundland because most of them are down on the south coast or they're way up on the north coast and you need to go in and do little harbors by boat. There's no paths or roads. And La Manche, this is one pass. It's, you know, you're right there in the town within 10 minutes. So, and it's just outside of St. John's. It's one of the closest ones to the capital. So maybe it's something to do with that, but I've heard a lot of different people, because I live right next to La Manche on the East Coast Trail. I'm the next town over in Brigus South. So I've heard a lot of different people who come up on the trail, which I'm on every day in the Brigus side. You know, you've said that they've felt weird in La Manche spending the night there. There's something odd about it, but they can't really put a finger on it.
Chris, it sounds to me like me and you have got like this awesome weekend coming up this summer. Well, we're going to go ghost hunting at La Manche, buddy.
I think you would love it.
I think you would love it too. Chris, you know, we've come to the end of this. Believe it or not, it's such a fast interview, man. And I tell you, it's been really interesting to talk to you. Tell us a little tiny bit about where we can find your book. I know you said you're dropping it on April 1st at Sci-Fi on the Rock, and which is very, very fitting, I might add.
Of course.
But after the initial release at Sci-Fi, where can people get a copy of your book?
The book is going to be available. It's actually available for pre-order right now for those who are outside Newfoundland or who otherwise not going to be able to get to the convention. You can go on Amazon.ca, Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk if you're over in Europe, and you can pre-order it there. You can go on Barnes & Noble and pre-order. You can go on the Kobo website and pre-order. It will very soon be available on iTunes. That was one of the last ones to get finalized. And after that, it's of course going to be available at Kohl's. And if you're outside of Canada, if you're outside of the U.S. where you won't want to have access to Barnes & Noble, if you're in Europe or Australia, then it should be available for distribution in your area as well. You might have to demand it from your local bookstore, but they will be able to bring it in. So it's going to be available pretty well worldwide.
I have this vision where I go to Kohl's bookstore and I have several different disguises and go in and demand a copy of the Golden Steel Saga 7 different times with 7 different voices.
I
think that'd be an awesome, awesome thing to do. Chris, thanks so much for being on the podcast. Remember, folks, you can find all his stuff on amazon.com.ca.uk. Also, check him out. Of course, he'll be appearing at Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10. The anniversary is going to be from April 1st to 3rd. Of course, is going to be coming up very, very soon. Catch Chris Walsh and a whole host of other wonderful local authors at Sci-Fi on the Rock number 10. Chris, from the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu from the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, bud. You have yourself a great night.
And you as well, John.
Well, the time to say goodbye is upon us. But don't worry, you can keep track of the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast very easily. It's available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner. Of course, if you'd like to keep up to date, you can always check out the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast Facebook page, drop a like, and every single time a new show goes up, you'll be notified. You can also follow me, John Mallard, on Twitter, at O-D-D-T-O-N-F-L-D. That's Odd to Newfoundland. Get your latest news on the podcast as well as the ever-popular para-joke of the day. From the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu from the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.